77 WABC. The following program does not necessarily reflect the views of WABC Radio.
The following program is brought to you by NYU Winthrop Hospital. It's the weekend. Be good to yourself. It's Katz's Corner with Dr. Aaron Katz, where you get simple, straightforward answers to your questions about health, from diet and supplements to lifestyle changes. To reach Dr. Katz, call 800-848-WABC. Now, live on 77 WABC, it's the chairman of urology at NYU Winthrop Hospital in New York. Here is Dr. Aaron Katz.
Good morning. Welcome to WABC, and as you can tell, this is not Dr. Katz. My name is Dr. Colin Brathwaite. I've had the pleasure of hosting for Dr. Katz in the past, and he is probably someplace warm and dry today as we start our show. I'm privileged to have today Dr. Joseph Tripodi, who is in the office. He is an attending gastroenterologist in the Department of Medicine at NYU Winthrop Hospital and a member of Gastrointestinal Associates of Long Island. And we'll be joined on the line during the during our presentation by Dr. Halwan, Barna Halwan, who's director of the Motility Center and an attending gastroenterologist also in the Department of Medicine at NYU Winthrop Hospital. And she's a member of Winthrop Gastroenterological Associates. And today, these doctors will discuss gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, including the symptoms, causes, and treatments. And they'll take calls from our listeners throughout the show. And again, the number 1-800-848-WABC, 1-800-848-WABC. And Dr. Tripodi is in the studio. So welcome, Dr. Tripodi.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Okay. So let's go right into it. What is GERD, G-E-R-D?
Well, GERD is an acronym for gastroesophageal reflux disease, and many people use that word interchangeably with a symptom of heartburn, which is the classic symptom of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And essentially, it's a feeling of burning in the substernal chest area under the breastbone that radiates up into the chest, towards the neck and throat, and occasionally into the back. Whereas GERD represents more of a disease spectrum comprised of various signs and symptoms and complications, all resulting from the backward movement of noxious gastric contents from the stomach up into the esophagus, the oral cavity, and even into the lungs at times. The disease is often subdivided into whether or not GERD patients have the presence or absence of erosions in the esophagus. And a vast majority of the patients that we see do not have erosions on their initial endoscopy. And that may be a factor due to the fact that most of these patients already have tried various agents already before seeing us in the office. And GERD is typically a relapsing illness, and it often becomes a recurrent problem once medications are withdrawn. And hence, a long-term strategy is often required to treat this disease.
So a person may have a heartburn. Can a person have heartburn and not have GERD? Or is heartburn a symptom of GERD? I just want to clarify for our audience.
Well, there are some people who have what's called functional heartburn, where when we measure the acid in their esophagus using a pH device, we can actually determine that they do not have significant amounts of acid, yet they have the classic heartburn symptom. And those patients are labeled as functional heartburn, and they're treated a little differently, and we can talk about that a little later on if we have some time. But that's not our classic reflux patient.
Okay.
That would be more of an atypical manifestation.
And how common is heartburn? I've heard that about 1 in 5 people suffer from GERD. Is that accurate?
It's fairly accurate. I mean, GERD tends to be one of the most common problems that patients present to the gastroenterologist for. In fact, about 60 million Americans actually have heartburn on a monthly basis, and about 15 million have it on a daily basis. And the worldwide prevalence is estimated to be anywhere from 8 to 33% of the population have reflux or heartburn symptoms.
And why is it important for us to be talking about this? What's the significance of GERD?
Well, there are many ramifications and symptoms of of gastroesophageal reflux disease, and patients are often concerned about various symptoms, especially chest pain. It can be confused with, you know, cardiac disease. It's important to delineate that their symptoms are coming from reflux and that we get them, you know, on the appropriate treatment. And the reason why, you know, people reflux is because of the lining of the esophagus, when it comes in contact with, you know, gastric juices, it actually can cause damage in that area. And that's often from a relaxation of the muscle at the end of the esophagus called the lower esophageal sphincter. And it's disruption or a disorderly function of that muscle that leads them to get the acid coming up into the esophagus and have symptoms. And that's, you know, finding that out is important to, you know, tailor the treatment so that they have relief of symptoms and they don't, you know, come into our emergency room or present to other doctors with symptoms that they think may be from something else.
So from what you're saying, it seems like that the symptoms can actually be masked. People can have symptoms from heartburn to actually having stuff, if it gets into their vocal cords, they can have hoarseness and a lot of other things like this. So people having these variety of symptoms should probably be evaluated and checked out because of the workup that's needed.
Well, indeed. I mean, the classic or cardinal symptoms of reflux, I think everyone's pretty familiar with, which is the heartburn and regurgitation, which, you know, are the classic symptoms. And interestingly enough, when patients do have those symptoms, they don't always correlate with the severity of disease, meaning some people can have severe heartburn, and when we look inside endoscopically, they don't necessarily have erosions. As a matter of fact, in studies, they've only shown that heartburn and regurgitation correlate with erosive disease, has about a 30 to 70% sensitivity. And those symptoms, even though they're the cardinal symptoms, are not always required to make the diagnosis. Some patients are presenting with other symptoms and don't have the classic, you know, heartburn and regurgitation. Those other symptoms could be, as we mentioned, cardiac type or the feeling like it's cardiac chest pain. And in fact, it's very important in those patients that we encourage them to get a complete, you know, cardiac workup before embarking on the gastrointestinal workup. They may also feel a symptom of difficulty with swallowing. That may be more of a complication of the reflux, such as the development of a stricture or a cancer that might develop from reflux. And as you mentioned, there is a myriad of extra esophageal manifestations. You touched on a few. You know, in the throat area, patients are often amazed when I tell them that their hoarseness of their voice or their chronic sore throat or sinusitis can actually be from reflux, and that there are potential, you know, ways of helping to improve those symptoms. In the lungs, the manifestation of reflux could be wheezing or worsening of their asthma or development of pneumonia or bronchitis. And sometimes patients even come from the dentist with a referral that their tooth enamel has been decayed, and that actually may be a manifestation of reflux as well. Interesting to note that the symptoms often decrease in the elderly patients.
Really?
And that's actually important. So sometimes you can't use symptoms to really judge how severe the disease is because they may not, outwardly vocalize, you know, these symptoms, but the disease could be, you know, progressing without them really complaining too much about symptoms.
So if a patient feels that they've had heartburn for some time, for quite some time, and then feel that the symptoms are getting better, and from their point of view, as they get older, that could be a false sense of security.
Correct. Correct. I think anyone with long-standing symptoms, really should be evaluated, because actually there's a condition which we'll get to a little later, which is called Barrett's esophagus, where the lining of the esophagus actually changes over to an intestinal-type epithelium. And that epithelium, when it's present in the esophagus, is actually less sensitive to acid, and thus their symptoms improve, but yet their disease could be still progressing. And as we can talk about later if we have some time, that, you know, Barrett's can be a precancerous condition in the esophagus, so it's very important to make sure that we evaluate those type of patients who have the long-standing symptoms, because they're more at risk for that type of problem.
Okay, well, let's try and bring in our other guest, Dr. Bonna Halwan, who's on the line. Dr. Halwan?
Yes. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So, Dr. Chipotle talked about the need for testing to identify GERD, especially in patients who may think that their symptoms are getting better. Can you give us an idea of some of the types of tests that are needed to evaluate GERD or to work it up?
Sure. So the acid reflux is usually diagnosed based upon symptoms and response to treatment. In people who have symptoms of acid reflux but no evidence of complications, meaning having difficulty swallowing, choking on the food, if they just have heartburn, regurgitation, simple symptoms, a trial of treatment with lifestyle changes and trial of acid-reducing medications are often recommended without any testing. The specific testing is required when the diagnosis is not clear or if there are more serious signs and symptoms such as chest pain, difficulty in swallowing food, choking on the food. So when we talk about the chest pain, as Dr. Chipotle pointed out, it can also be a symptom of heart disease. So it is important to rule out potentially life-threatening problems that can cause symptoms similar to those of reflux. So we need to get the heart checked out first. And when the diagnosis is not clear, still the tests that can be performed include, one of the tests is upper GI series. That's a very simple test. This is done by a radiologist where a patient swallows a liquid barium mixture. The radiologist uses a fluoroscope to watch the barium as it travels down the esophagus into the stomach. It is a good test to assess for any major kind of major anatomical changes such as hiatal hernia. It can also show us some narrowing of the esophagus from stricture, or it can also show us reflux during this testing.
So that's basically your barium swallow test that patients talk about.
Yes, correct. Okay. The other test that we use is an upper endoscopy. It is a test that involves passing a small, lighted, flexible tube through the mouth into the esophagus. And it is done with the help of sedatives by anesthesiologists who gives these, sedatives. It is the best test to assess for any inflammation of the esophagus, any irritation in the lining of the esophagus, and also to assess for precancerous changes such as Barrett's esophagus. So that's the other test that we use. The other testing that we...
And just to reiterate, the patient is asleep during this test, so people don't feel like they have to be awake while this test is being done. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
So the other test we do is called esophageal manometry study. That is generally basically a test that is done in the office. This test, patients are awake. It involves passing a small flexible tube through the nose into the esophagus. This manometry test is basically measures how your sphincter, the lower esophageal sphincter, is functioning to see if it's loose. People who have very loose, relaxed sphincter, they're more risk of reflux. It also measures the muscle contractions of the esophagus. So this test is done when the diagnosis is unclear, or when patient is considering some surgical treatment. So prior to any surgical treatment, or when the diagnosis is unclear, the esophageal manometry test is necessary. And also when you have atypical chest pain, to assess if there are any spasm of the esophagus. This is the test that is done in the office. The other test that we do is called the pH testing. This is a more direct way to measure the frequency of acid reflux. This is again the test is done when the diagnosis is not clear after having an endoscopy or after a trial of treatment. Patient continues to have symptoms. It is also a useful test for people who continue to have symptoms despite having treatment with acid suppressive medication. They continue to have symptoms. And also tests to do before they go for any surgical therapy, if they're considering, to manage their reflux.
Okay. So just to summarize, patients can have an X-ray test, which is the barium swallow. They can have an endoscopy, which is the scope that you mentioned with the lighted catheter that's put down. And then pH testing is another test to confirm that there's acid coming up. And you also mentioned manometry. So on the one hand, you want to diagnose GERD, but on the other, you want to make sure that you rule out other conditions, is what I'm gathering.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. And what are some of the complications of GERD? Why is this so important? Why are we talking about this?
The majority of the people with reflux will not develop serious complications, particularly when reflux is adequately treated. There are symptoms that indicate that one should see the doctor right away. If you have like trouble with swallowing, you are unintentionally losing weight, you're choking when you eat, or you're vomiting blood, or you have like black tarry stools, so that means you have some complications and you need to see the doctor right away. Some of the complications that can happen is, inflammation, irritation in the lining of the esophagus, ulcerations in the esophagus as a result of stomach acid damaging the lining of the esophagus. Over a period of time, when the damage continues to happen, there could be stricturing of the esophagus, meaning a narrowing of the esophagus. This happens when the acid can cause, scarring and narrowing of the esophagus, and then patient will have, food or the pills that will get stuck in their esophagus. Some people, as Dr. Cipolli also pointed out, that some people can have lung and throat problems. The reflux, some of the patients, especially at nighttime when they're sleeping, they can reflux, aspirate the acid material into their lungs, and that can lead to aspiration pneumonia. And over a long period of time, that can lead to a permanent lung damage called pulmonary fibrosis, and that is irreversible. Other people can have worsening of their asthma, or people who have asthma just at nighttime. I mean, to keep that in mind, that this could be all related to reflux disease. The other complications that we see that happens in 10% of the people with chronic reflux disease is something called Barrett's esophagus.
That's the precancerous condition that Dr. Tripodi talked about, right?
That's correct, correct. And this happens when the normal cells that line the esophagus are replaced by a different type of cells. This usually happens after repeated damages to the esophageal lining. When this change in the lining happens, as Dr. Tripodi pointed out, that people may complain of less heartburn because this lining is acid resistant. So people feel that, they had reflux heartburn for many years, and all of a sudden their symptoms went away. So this could are less severe now than it used to be. So that's something to keep in mind. These new type of cells that Barrett's esophagus have a small risk of transforming into cancer cells. So these patients should be followed by periodic upper endoscopy.
Okay. So let me just mention again, I'm Dr. Colin Brathwaite. I'm guest hosting for Dr. Katz, and I have two very well-known guests, Dr. Joseph Tripodi, attending gastroenterologist in the Department of Medicine at NYU Winthrop Hospital. He's in the studio, and Dr. Barna Halwan, who's the director of the Motility Center, another attending gastroenterologist at Winthrop, and she's on the line. And these doctors are talking about gastroesophageal reflux disease, including symptoms, causes, and treatments. So let's move on to talk about some treatment options, because I think that's what patients want to hear about. What are the ways that GERD can be treated?
I'll take that question. Typically, we start off in a stepwise approach, and I think Dr. Halwan had mentioned some of the lifestyle modifications. I'll just review them in a little more detail. I mean, obviously, patients who are overweight, we recommend you know, a weight loss program, and there's definitely been data to show that, you know, obesity is associated with worsening reflux disease. And sometimes even patients might be better off going for a bariatric type surgery to actually help with their reflux as well as to help them lose weight. Head-of-the-bed elevation is often another thing we recommend, and there's some randomized trials to show that that actually is helpful, especially for those who have nocturnal, you know, heartburn symptoms. Avoiding eating 2 to 3 hours before bedtime, especially, you know, fatty meals, is a prudent thing to recommend. Avoiding tight-fitting clothes and discontinuing things like alcohol and tobacco is often recommended. Eliminating food triggers such as chocolate, caffeine, peppermint, and garlic may be also of benefit, especially when when patients note that their symptoms are worsened by those type of food agents. Those failing the lifestyle interventions should be recommended to have an empiric trial of medical therapy. Of course, if they do not have the alarm symptoms that Dr. Halwan mentioned, the weight loss or the anemia or dysphagia, you know, then you could try an empiric trial, and that could include, you know, liquid antacids such as Tums or Gaviscon, Rolaids, those type of things. But often they're very ineffective and short-lived, those medications. And we move on to H2 blockers, things like ranitidine and famotidine, which I'm sure many of us are familiar with and are now over-the-counter and have been available since the 1970s. They do improve symptoms of GERD and regurgitation, but only in about 50% of patients. And healing of erosive esophagitis requires high doses of these medications, and they're only able to maintain remission in a small percentage of patients, about 25%. Then we move on in the next stepwise fashion to the proton pump inhibitor group, which many of us are familiar with, omeprazole, who's also now available over-the-counter, but much more effective at healing and much faster in onset of relief of symptoms. But we have to make sure that our patients are taking it correctly. I mean, many of our patients come in and are taking it at bedtime, and this drug needs to be taken a half hour to an hour before eating a meal in order to trigger the release of the medication and to help it bind on to the proton pumps so you can shut them down and reduce the acid production. There's no scientific reason that supports the withdrawal of these medications after a year of use, but many patients come in and are concerned that they're on this long term. But this is, as we said in the top of the show, that this condition is a very long-standing, chronic condition and often requires chronic therapy to keep it under control, much like someone who took medicine for high blood pressure. Once the blood pressure comes under control, you still need to take your medications to maintain it. Well, similar in reflux disease, you need to maintain the medications. Lots of patients ask about whether or not they should be treated for H. pylori or check for H. pylori. There's no role in H. pylori in reflux disease. And carafate also has no role in the treatment of reflux, except maybe in those patients who are pregnant. And maintenance therapy, and as we said, is usually necessary if someone doesn't have alarm symptoms or doesn't have severe esophagitis. We might want to back down and use on-demand therapy for maintenance. However, those patients who have Barrett's or more of the severe degrees of erosive esophagitis, and we grade them based on the LA classification. So the more severe classification would be C and D range. Those patients are almost always going to need to be on daily maintenance therapy in order to maintain the healing of those erosions in the esophagus and to prevent the sequelae such as Barrett's esophagus. I think we'll leave it at that for the medical management for now. There are other therapies that are kind of available that we can use off-label when patients are failing those and even sometimes have to escalate therapy to use twice daily therapy for treatment. And when you do use twice daily therapy, I recommend taking the evening dose a half hour before dinner for the same reasons we mentioned earlier as far as the physiology behind the way the drug works rather than taking that second dose, you know, at bedtime.
Okay. Dr. Halwan, did you have anything to add before we discuss some surgical options?
I think pretty much Dr. Tripodi covered, you know, I agree, you know, overall. But one thing is like 40% of the people will fail the treatment, you know, due to compromise the anti-reflux barrier because their sphincter is, you know, very loose or they have large hiatal hernia. They may have some concomitant issues such as gastroparesis, or they are on certain medications that affect the sphincter, such as blood pressure medications or narcotics. So in these patients, you know, I think the other alternative therapy, or patients who do not want to be on medications, you know, that's other alternatives such as, you know, surgical options.
Okay. Dr. Chipotle, you wanted to add something else?
I was just also would like to mention there are two other endoscopic therapies that may also be available for treatment of reflux disease. One is called radiofrequency ablation, where they use electromagnetic waves to heat the tissue at the lower esophagus and hopefully to augment the lower esophageal sphincter. But data has been mixed on this approach. And there's also a second endoscopic modality called the TIF procedure, which is an acronym for transoral incisionless fundal application, which basically uses fasteners that are placed endoscopically at the lower esophageal sphincter to create an endoscopic plication of the lower esophagus. And data also has been mixed in on this as well, although they recently published 5-year data to show that 80% had resolution of atypical symptoms and reflux scores had improved. However, 54% of patients at 5 years were still either on daily or intermittent PPI therapy after undergoing this procedure. Therefore, I think these two endoscopic treatments have a limited role in the long-term management of reflux, and perhaps the role would be most in patients who have allergies to proton pump inhibitors or are poorly compliant with medical therapy and not really interested in a surgical intervention. However, there is recent data from the surgical literature on a new procedure called a magnetic sphincter augmentation, which is also called LINX. I say new, but it's been around for around 5 years or so, and the data has been encouraging, and it suggests that it might be a viable option to the traditional anti-reflux surgery. And I would refer this back to Dr. Brathwaite to give us a few key data points about this exciting new treatment.
Okay. So in the last few minutes, seconds remaining, I can really talk about LINX from a personal standpoint. I think it's studies have been done showing that over 3,000 patients have used this and had significant freedom from their medications, over 90% of patients. This is something that we're applying in patients. It's minimally invasive. Patients get to go home the same day, and they don't have to change their diet. If you need further questions regarding LINX, you can call this number, 1-833-502-GERD, 1-833-502-GERD, and you'll be referred to Dr. Holwan or Dr. Chipotle and myself, and we'll be happy to take care of you. Thank you for listening to WABC. My name is Dr. Brathwaite, hosting for Dr. Katz. We've been privileged to have Dr. Chipotle and Dr. Holwan talking about GERD, G-E-R-D, and acid reflux. Thank you.
WABC, New York.